From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Today, I want to talk about one of the most important and least talked about facets of cooking: what happens when you make a mistake.
A mistake is a bad thing only until it is fixed, at which point it becomes not only good, but magic. Mistakes are the swept-up stardust that success sparkles with.
The opening to Cal Peternell's book sums up a lot of my cooking experience. In real life, sometimes you reach for the salt instead of the sugar. Cal Peternell is all about taking inspiration from disappointment. Exhibit 1, burnt toast. Why throw it away when you can blend it to a grind for meatballs or to thicken soup or make a simple onion panade? And what other tricks does he have for remedying a kitchen disaster? Let's find out. Hi, Cal.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm great. It's wonderful to have you. I just love this new book. It's just filled with personality. It's so funny.
Thanks.
Obviously, we can look at your new book, Burnt Toast and Other Disasters, as a manual of hacks, but it's the underlying philosophy that I find so much more interesting in a way. It's about focusing on maximizing flavor when ingredients or circumstances aren't optimal. And because, you know, let's face it, for you living in the Bay Area and having been the chef at Chez Panisse for a couple of decades, and me, well, doing what I do and living in Southern California, it's pretty easy for us to access optimal ingredients. What was the circumstance that made you cook outside your bubble like this?
Well, I think it was a combination of things, but primarily it came from when I would travel, visiting family or on vacation, and I, you know, didn't have the amazing access that I usually have here. And like you said, you enjoy down there. And I would, you know, I would try and do my usual, I'm going to cook for everyone, and that means it starts at the market and I go and see what looks good. But I realized, well, what if nothing really looks that good, particularly? Then what do you do? So I started to try and figure that out. And I also felt like, you know, it's a book about mistakes. And sometimes it's the mistake that you made because maybe you burnt the toast or you overcooked the rice or you made some other cooking error. But sometimes it's like the mistake was that, you know, the ground beef has been sealed up in a package for like a little too long and it's not, you know, it's not gone bad, but it's just not great anymore. Or maybe the only vegetables you could get were the same old ones you always get. Or maybe they were good vegetables, but that was like a week ago. And now you've got them and you've got to make something great.
Before we move on, tell me more about this onion panade and also the options for burnt toast.
Panade is like a dish that I've made for many years. Learned it from one of my former colleagues, Russell Moore, who now has a wonderful restaurant here in Berkeley called The Kebabry. And he showed me how to make this. And I just realized, you know, if the bread is a little bit, and panade, if for those who don't know, is sort of, it's almost like a lasagna in a way that you make with, instead of pasta, you use bread. And so you sort of layer toasted bread with flavorful ingredients, and then you bake it, and it all comes together. And the one I have in here is just a really simple version where you're using your pieces of burnt, you know, and of course, if the toast is burnt, like it's filling the house with smoke, then that's time to just make a new piece of toast. But if you get some bread that's a little bit too burnt, or maybe you toasted it yesterday for something, and now it's still around, and it's kind of stale, you can layer it with lots of onions that you've cooked, and a little bit of cheese if you want, and some herbs if you've got them. And I like to pour a really good chicken stock over it, and you bake it. And it's just kind of one of those things that is better than the sum of its parts. And then I have another option where you, instead of just using a stock, basically you use kind of a custard mixture of cream and milk and eggs. And then, you know, there's in that chapter, the burnt chapter, I go on to talk about what if you burnt the vegetables? What if you overcooked the rice? And there's rescues. There's things that you can do. There's moments when you need to call it a day on whatever that ingredient is and, you know, make yourself an omelet for dinner and try again tomorrow. But often you can save it and come up with something that's really quite delicious.
So for people who haven't succumbed to the joys of a rice cooker and are still kind of flailing around making rice on the stovetop, there are occasions when the rice is mushy. So I know what I would do with that. I would just turn it into a porridge. But what do you recommend for hacks for mushy rice?
Yeah, I have a couple of them. One is that you can make like a rice pudding. And I like this one where I mix ginger and coconut milk in. And you can either eat it hot or you can let it get cold, which is sort of what I prefer. And then the other one that's really fun is rice pancakes. And you mix in some flour and a little baking soda. And then I like to put in lots of turmeric because it makes it look a beautiful color. And other spices like cumin and paprika, scallions and egg. And you stir it up and then you just fry them up just like you would pancakes. But they're savory. Although they're pretty good with eaten like with syrup on them too, as my son Liam taught me. And then, you know, you can garnish it with yogurt is great, chopped cilantro. I usually have a jar of like some kind of mango pickle or lime pickle in the back of my fridge that I that tastes great with those. And they're good as like a side with like meat or chicken or other vegetables. They're also good as like a little hors d'oeuvre kind of thing. You can make little tiny ones and just pop them in your mouth.
In the Peter Nell vernacular, BS stands for boneless, skinless.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And aside from asking what they do with all that skin and bone, give us some ways to jazz up that particular blank canvas of a chicken breast.
Yeah, I don't know when it happened that suddenly chicken was often sold without the skin. But if you find yourself with the version that doesn't have any skin, you know, there's a number of things with the thighs. The thighs are a little more forgiving because they're a little fattier, but I coat them with lots of Dijon mustard and a little bit of flour and kind of fry them up and then braise them. And it makes this nice kind of thickened sauce that's kind of tangy from the mustard. Another one that I like that my wife has been making and is really delicious is I take chipotles just like out of the can and marinate the thighs with the chipotle and some cumin and a little bit of honey and then roast it. And it's sort of barbecue-y tasting and really pretty delicious, great with lime squeezed over it. And then actually one that I really love, you know, I've been making ragus, like various versions of like bolognese or other kind of meat ragus in the Italian style for decades. And I'm always very careful to dice the onions, carrots, and celery and very carefully cook them for a really long time until they're almost like sort of jammy. And then I set them aside and then I cook the meat. And then, you know, it's lots of steps, which I love to do. But I just thought one day, like, well, what if you just, you know, what if you can't cut up mirepoix the same way I can? And what if, or you just don't want to take all that time? What if you just used a cheese grater to just grate everything? And so I grated onion, I grated carrot, I grated celery, I grated in some tomato. I added the chicken thighs, seasoned but not browned at all, some cream, some water, and just put it in I think it called for like a 400-degree oven, and let it go, let it just sort of cook away. And turns out that also works really well. So that one was a bit of a revelation to me and was actually one of the things that was such a fun challenge about this book is, you know, taking apart some of the dishes that I've done forever and thought, like, what if you skipped some steps? How would that work out? And it often works out pretty well.
And there's also some suggestions for what to do with completely unelevated ingredients, like that box mm-hmm. of macaroni and cheese.
Yeah,
I have to say the one that I know I'm going to make is the peas.
Yeah, there's I call it hackaroni and cheese. And and there's actually, you know what? The one that my son loved the most, my teenage son, was the one that has corn, cilantro, and lime, which was like this pasta that we used to make in the cafe at Chez Panisse. And, you know, of course, we used like hand-cut noodles and we had beautiful creme fraiche. But I was thinking, like, what if you just used a little less of the cheese stuff and added corn and a little cream and lots of lime and cilantro and scallions? And that one is really great. Also, by the way, and I'm sure there's kids in college who would be saying, yeah, no kidding, but that you can take that leftover cheese packet if you didn't use the whole one and sprinkle it over popcorn works really well.
So yeah. I have to ask you, is butter the ultimate hack?
I mean, in a way it is. You know, I was talking to some friends last night about that. And, you know, there's that thing people like, oh, if you put enough butter on it, everything will taste good. And I know what they mean, but, you know, just slathering tons of butter on everything makes it okay. But I have other ideas about what you can do with the butter, like compound butters where you soften some butter and mix in herbs or spices or garlic or capers or those kinds of things. Really helpful. I make little logs of it and then slice them into little discs and pop them in the freezer. And then when you know, if you do have that piece of chicken that didn't have skin on it and it's kind of boring, you just pull one out and set it on top of there and it melts and there you go. You've got all that flavor in there. Or you can stir it into just like plain rice. Brown butter, as you know, is like a much more interesting flavor, and you can kind of brown the butter and then throw in some sage or some nuts and let those sizzle in there for a second, and that is its own sauce. And then there's the sort of classic sort of French technique of, like, if you've cooked, say, chicken in a pan, that you can deglaze the pan with a little liquid, whether it's wine or water or stock. And when that reduces to almost like a sort of syrupy consistency, if you throw in some cold butter and swirl it around, it makes this kind of creamy sauce that is really nice poured over whatever thing you've just cooked, whether it's chicken or fish or even vegetables.
Well, I want to thank you, Cal, for coming by Good Food and also for this book. It's so entertaining, and it really... these days, I think all of us need to be sort of jolted out of our routine, and there's a lot of great ideas in this book. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's Chef Cal Peternell, author, artist, and culinary problem solver. His book is Burnt Toast and Other Disasters. Coming up. For over 60 years, La Gloria has supplied the city of Los Angeles with a daily run of fresh tortillas. But a land dispute leaves the tortilla dynasty in limbo. We hear their incredible story when Good Food returns.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. La Gloria is a tortilla dynasty. They've been in business since 1954, handing ownership of their operations from family member to family member. But more than 60 years later, they may be forced to close. The reason? A drawn-out land dispute with the city of Los Angeles. Company president Maria Bejar Vera and her daughter Cindy Vera join us now to tell us what's at stake in this week's In the Weeds.
My name is Maria Vera. I'm the president of La Gloria Foods Corporation.
So my name is Cindy Vera. I'm the daughter of Maria Vera, the president of La Gloria, and I help the company out in public relations matters.
I was 6 years old when we came from Mexico, and those days I remember my parents working very hard. It was like a new experience because none of us spoke English. It was a small location at that time, and my mother and my father were the only workers, so they ran the machine themselves in the night, and we would sleep in the back room while they worked in the morning hours. I learned to make tortillas. My father... he had already a tortilla factory in Mexico City, so he had experience in the old way of making tortillas. When he came to the United States, the machinery was different than in Mexico. It was a bit more automated, and in Mexico it was more of a hand type of a machine. He would wake up every morning, like at 2 a.m, and it was very admirable for me to see him. While my mother was at the factory, he would go out and go into the different markets, the different counties, to try to get customers for our company. And then he would ask me to interpret for him many times because he didn't know English. And I didn't know much myself at 6 years old, but I try to help, and I always admired my dad.
So in terms of my memories of La Gloria, they're very similar to my mom's in that I grew up in the business as well. So preschool years, there is actually a daycare room up where the offices are. So my cousins and I, we grew up there in that daycare room, and we were always beside the factory. We grew up playing whenever we could take a break and go down to the factory, hear the machines, smell the corn. Me in particular, I'm the eldest granddaughter, so I was closest to my grandparents, and I had sleepovers. And so my mom mentioned the first batch of tortillas is manufactured like at 2 a.m. And I remember being awoken at 2 a.m. by the sound of the machines. And that to me was very soothing for whatever reason. Once I went to college, I kind of ventured out into a different profession, but I've always been called back throughout my years. Back in 2013, we were approached by a couple of workers from the Los Angeles City of Department of Public Works who shared that they were interested in moving forward with a project. It's called the Roundabout Project. So that is located near our flour plant over at the intersection of Lorena and Cesar Chavez. And what they envision there is creating a new veterans memorial and making a roundabout, because they claim that intersection is very dangerous. So in order to create this roundabout, they needed to take over some properties there in the area, La Gloria being one of them. In the next couple years, there was communication and correspondence back and forth. And by 2015, they had already purchased the factory from us. So they have owned that land since 2015. Since 2015, when they took over the property and then owned it, we were in negotiations back and forth. So we have our expert consultant who has come up with figures as to what it would cost to relocate all of our equipment to a new location. And the city seemed to be working with us. Now, what happened was there were figures going back and forth between the city and La Gloria, and everything looked like it was moving in the right direction. Then COVID hit. When COVID hit, everything naturally just went into shutdown mode, and we heard nothing. In May of 2021, we received a letter from the city attorney of Los Angeles named Mike Fuhrer. And in that letter, he is saying that because you've been in violation and have not granted us access to evaluate, you know, your inventory and look at your plants, we are now offering you nothing. The legal matter since 2021, when we received the zero offer from the city, has been extremely tolling for my mother. 1 month later, she comes to me and said, you know, I want you to drive me to the hospital. I'm not well. Something does not feel well. Long story short, we took her to the emergency room. She was admitted. She's had 2 heart operations since June. So to say that it has, been a source of stress on her, it's really an understatement. She's expressed to me that when she hears zero offer, she said she would rather just die than, to stop fighting for justice and for fair compensation for all the decades and all. And when I say blood, sweat, and tears, it's literally blood and sweat and tears, because my grandfather actually lost limbs in growing the company over the decades. It's very tolling.
I would like just to say that we would just like to be treated fairly. You know, we are three women, my two sisters and I own the business. We're three Latinas. We've always struggled through 67 years. We want to continue our business. You know, where other big corporations have come down, like, for example, Kmart and Mervyn's, La Gloria is still standing. We want to continue feeding our community. We want to continue employing people from the community, our own family. And all we want is, you know, justice. It was their objective to do the roundabout. So, you know, I think they should just pay what is fair. That's all we want, just to be compensated. It's difficult to find, like, a family whose grandma or relative has not heard of La Gloria. We are part of the Latino community of Boyle Heights. And because of 67 years that we've been in business, a lot of the Latino community still knows us and supports us.
That was Maria Bejar Vera, president and owner of La Gloria Mexican Foods, along with her daughter, Cindy Vera, who's the company's director of public relations. As we get closer to our in-person tortilla tournament, it's time once again to reach out to Gustavo Arellano to find out where we are in the judging process. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
So this great tortilla tournament of champions is happening on what date?
It's going to be October 10th at Smorgasburg, LA, which is at the Row DTLA. So it's going to be in person. We're going to have our Fuerte Four. So once we get to the Fuerte Four, our four finalists, they're going to be selling tortillas there. We are going to be doing the judging in person, and we're going to determine who is the winner between corn and flour of the golden tortilla.
Such a heavy responsibility.
It's a lot.
You're tasting it in front of everybody, and you're like...
Somehow we've been able to do it for three years. Of course, last year was even via Zoom, and it is tough, but people want to know. People want that champion because people need great tortillas. And so heavy lies a tortilla crown for us, but someone has to do it.
So last week we talked about the Suave 16. This week we're at the SO8. Tell me what's been going on in your corn category that you and Connie Alvarez of KCRW are judging.
So last week in my category, we had Taco Maria, the titan of blue corn, Michelin-starred restaurant down in Costa Mesa, versus Meat La Cafe, oldest Mexican restaurant in the Inland Empire. Meat La Cafe makes a great corn tortilla, but they're just no match for the behemoth that is Taco Maria. Again, the only tortilla ever to make it into our final 3 years in the row. And in the other category, oh my Lord, Trader Joe started as a number 15 seed. They had one year, and I did not expect them to do much. They beat the number 2 seed. They beat another seed. And this past week, they beat Carnitas El Rey, which is an amazing corn tortilla from Oxnard. I'm telling you, folks, Trader Joe's corn tortilla, you look at the label, just corn, water, and lime, just like all great corn tortillas have. And what's amazing about that tortilla, it has a taste of a gordita tortilla. So it has a taste of a thicker corn tortilla, but it's a thin tortilla. Trader Joe's doesn't make their own corn tortillas. They have someone else do it. I would love to know who's the secret tortillero in Southern California who does it.
And that's what I was going to ask you. Do we know that mystery?
I'm sure I could find out, but then I would get a tortilleria in trouble. So even if I found out, I would not rat them out. But Trust me, I did not ever imagine Trader Joe's to be going that far, but you have to go with the best tortilla. And the same thing is happening actually in Connie's bracket. So you have Tallulah's, that really good high-end Mexican restaurant in Santa Monica, who makes an amazing blue corn tortilla made from masa from Hacienda, which works with non-GMO organic corn from Mexico. They beat Amapola Deli, which is this famous Mercado chain, a supermarket chain in Southeast LA. So Tallulah's is in the SOA, and they're facing off against La Princesita.
That is so hard. I really think blue corn facing off against white or yellow corn, that is some of the hardest judging I've ever done.
We have to do that judging. And look, blue corn tortillas are great, but we had a blue corn tortilla entrant in this tortilla tournament this year, and they lost in the first round. So they still have to match up. And that's what La Princesita, which is, by the way, is a machine-made tortilla, historically, machine-made tortillas have not gone very far in the tortilla tournament, whether corn or flour. Now in their SOA, they beat another machine-made tortilla, La Rancherita out of Santana.
So interesting. And I just have to say, in my category for the SOA, this was a nightmare. I mean, it was Sonora Town versus Burritos La Palma. You really have to be, it's almost like a Zen thing where you're like, okay, I'm not deciding on the historical flavor profile of each of these tortillas over the past year. It is today with what is in front of me on the comal right now.
Oh, yeah. So Sonora Town, the first winner of our golden tortilla, Burrito La Palma, you know, beloved birria de res makers in Southern California. They're from the same part of Mexico where I'm from, Jerez. And in your category, Sonora Town beat Barama, which, of course, is Joseph Centeno's Tex-Mex restaurant, which makes great flour tortillas. And Burrito La Palma, they beat Graciana's Tamale Factory, which has been making tortillas in Sylmar since 1938. I mean, this is the great thing about this tournament of champions. It gets harder and harder, and I can't even imagine matching up Sonora Town versus Burrito La Palma. Wow, good luck there, Evan.
It's daunting, you know, because these tortilla makers are so competitive. And once they've won the golden tortilla, man, they won another one.
Oh, yeah. And it happens all the time. And that's actually what's happening in the category for Mona Holmes of Eater LA in her flour tortilla category. Home State, which is the defending champion from last year, they beat Salazar from Frogtown easily with their amazing Tex-Mex style, puffy, buttery flour tortilla. Nothing against Salazar because their tortillas are awesome. And then the other matchup, you have an upset. Anchos, this Southwestern style Tex-Mex El Torito clone from Riverside, which makes an amazing, amazing flour tortilla, small and puffy. They beat El Ruso, which everyone has loved El Ruso for the past couple of years with their Sonora style, very thin tortillas. But Anchos won. So Inland Empire versus Highland Park. Wow, that's going to be an amazing category as well.
I also think it's hilarious that this tiny little ancho tortilla went up against El Ruso's Sobaquero.
Yeah, like the big, huge flour tortillas versus literally these tortillas are even smaller than Home State's tortillas. And Home State's tortillas are pretty small and they make them for breakfast tacos. These are almost like snacks and they sell them at Anchos for like, they'll sell you a bag of a dozen for about $3 or so. And they really take pride in their flour tortillas though. They have the little tortilla machine right in the center of the dining room and they're making them in the morning. And then the place will be packed for lunch. Everyone's having their big combo platters and you're like, these people don't know what good food is. But then you have that flour tortilla. You're like, wow, I wish this wasn't in Riverside so I could go more often.
Yeah. Now you made me, you know, you said the word combo platter and it just activated my childhood thing. So I'm just really excited that that we're doing this. I'm thrilled we're going to be gathering together live. But I also want to make sure that our listeners know how much great content there is on the website leading up to the day. So why don't you remind us what people will find at kcrw.com/tortilla.
Oh, my Lord. We're trying to get at least 4 original articles every week. So we have a roundup, kind of like the roundup we talked about. I do an original profile on a legendary tortilla maker. I also brought back my Ask a Tortilla Judge column where I answer people's questions about tortillas. Everything to how do you properly freeze a tortilla to if Gavin Newsom and Larry Elder were tortillas, what kind of tortilla brands would they be? And yes, there is an answer to them. So yeah, go to kcrw.com/tortilla and you'll find all sorts of great content.
Well, thank you, Gustavo. It's always a pleasure.
Gracias.
That was Gustavo Arellano, el jefe of Gustavo and KCRW's Great Tortilla Tournament of Champions. Check out kcrw.com/tortilla to find the most up-to-date tortilla brackets and for a map where you can find every single tortilleria in this year's contest. And mark your calendar for October 10th. That will be the final showdown when we determine who wins this year's Golden Tortilla. The event is happening a week from tomorrow at Smorgasburg at the Row in downtown LA. It's free and open to the public. You can RSVP at kcrw.com/tortilla and we'll send you everything you need to know to attend the event. In a minute, it's the Attack of the Superweeds. And no, it is not a Halloween story. But yes, it is a bit spooky. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Many of us know about Roundup, the spectacularly successful pesticide designed to kill emerging weeds, as well as the genetically modified seeds branded as Roundup Ready that are paired to survive the glyphosate bath. But did you know that the evolution of plant material in the face of such pesticides has created, drumroll, superweeds? H. Claire Brown wrote about them in her New York Times Magazine article, Attack of the Superweeds. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. The article that you wrote for the Times is really fascinating. What is a superweed?
So superweeds are weeds that have evolved resistance to weed killers because of the repeated use of the same management tactic. So in the way that you're talking about glyphosate, that's kind of why we're the most familiar with them. But something could also be a superweed, according to the definition used by weed scientists, if, say, it evolves to grow laterally to avoid the blade of a lawnmower, or if it evolves to look like little rice seedlings to avoid hand weeding.
Wow. And how bad are they for agriculture right now?
It's hard to pinpoint an exact dollar amount of the damage that they have caused simply because superweeds are evolving faster than scientists can actually count them. But the most recent estimate puts the annual damage at billions of dollars.
Wow. So let's talk about Palmer amaranth, because this is one of the weeds that you really focused on. How long did it take for that plant to catch up to the pesticides that were meant to eradicate them?
So Palmer amaranth is this really amazing plant. It can grow 3 inches a day. And the thing that's really incredible about it is that a female plant can produce hundreds of thousands of seeds every year, and it mates sexually. And so when you have one plant reproducing, it has this incredible genetic diversity in its offspring. So what that means is that some of those offspring are randomly sprouted with the ability to resist some herbicides. So most recently, Bayer, which is a company that recently acquired Monsanto, released, I think it was in 2016, a seed bred to tolerate dicamba, which is an old herbicide, but which we hadn't seen much resistance issues with. And the Palmer amaranth weeds caught up in about 5 years. They suspected dicamba-resistant Palmer amaranth in 2019, and they confirmed it in 2021.
Do we know what the cost is of the weeds in lost crops and time fighting them?
So one scientist I spoke to said that the cost of weed control has about doubled in the last 10 or 15 years. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly how that translates into the cost of our food, simply because a lot of the corn and soy that has the biggest resistance problem is later used further down the supply chain. So it's fed to animals, which shows up as higher meat prices, or it's turned into oil. So it's difficult to trace the cost in kind of a consumer grocery bill, but for a farmer, it's basically twice as expensive as it used to be to control weeds.
And you say in your article that in the arms race between biology and biotechnology, the weeds are winning. And yet you mentioned that growers seem to be clinging to the unrealistic idea that chemical companies will once again invent a, quote, miraculous new herbicide before it's too late.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, scientists are starting to refer to glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, as a once-in-a-century herbicide. That's a little bit of an upgrade from a once-in-a-generation herbicide, which is how they talked about it a while ago. And so what happened when glyphosate was introduced was that it was so good, companies kind of stopped developing new chemicals. And so there's really nothing in the pipeline coming down the line to replace glyphosate. And I think that's where the concern lies. I think lots of farmers that I interviewed for this piece are hoping that there will be some kind of magic solution in the way that glyphosate has been a magic solution for many people's entire careers. And that's where the real tension lies with this issue.
Are there any large-scale farmers that are looking to take a more integrated approach to pest management?
So the understanding I got from talking to weed scientists is that there are some, but they're a little bit few and far between. There's just not the data yet to show that, you know, here's how row crops work after three decades of trying. The farmer I profiled in the story, Darren Nicolette, though, has been doing a ton of different innovative approaches, and they sound really simple. You know, he'll plant soybean rows closer together so that they can choke out the weeds a little bit earlier in the life cycle. Or he will wait a little bit longer before he gets rid of the cover crop so that the weeds have less time to grow in the empty soil. So there are some techniques that weed scientists are encouraging right now. It's just that wide-scale adoption has not been just there yet.
Could you explain a little bit the plant biology, how weeds adapt? I mean, it's their major personality trait, right?
Absolutely. So the best metaphor that someone gave me for this story was kind of a lock and key analogy. So if you think of a vulnerable part in a plant cell as a lock and an herbicide as the key, in the past, a specific herbicide would target a specific part in the plant. So some herbicides would make a plant not be able to retain water and it would essentially die of thirst. What happens when a weed evolves is two different things. First of all, it can essentially change the locks. What that means is that the site that the weed killer is targeting changes so that it's a different shape and the weed killer can't affect it. Or in the case of glyphosate, the plant cell makes a bunch of the different genes that glyphosate targets. So even if it does get one key in the lock, there are a bunch of other locks that are left unharmed. What's happening now that's really starting to alarm scientists and farmers is that weeds are evolving a different kind of resistance. So if you think about the lock and key analogy again, it's like you're positioning a doorman in front of the door and just not even letting the key enter the lock in the first place. They call that metabolic resistance. And the implication is that the weed killers scientists will try on new weeds just might not work at all.
Why was Roundup and Roundup Ready Seed so seductive that it took over this sector so completely?
You know, I think in many ways, glyphosate was pretty miraculous. It broke down in the environment very quickly. So at the time, there were other pesticides that were having really big problems leaching into the water, causing birth defects in frogs. There really wasn't a whole lot of that with glyphosate. The other thing is that it just worked really well. You know, many herbicides will kill just one type of weed, like a grass or a broadleaf weed. Glyphosate would kill everything, and it was really cheap at the outset. So it was just kind of, it was almost a miracle drug for a long time, and people really rushed to adopt it.
So the big question, it seems, is if the pesticides are creating these monster weeds, what are they doing to us, to humans?
That's a really good question and one I didn't spend a whole lot of time with in the article. Bayer, the company that owns Monsanto, continues to deny that glyphosate causes any problems to human health, but there has been a lawsuit brought by gardeners claiming that glyphosate causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And judges have decided on behalf of the plaintiffs in those lawsuits. So Bayer is on the hook for kind of billions of dollars in damages for this potential link between glyphosate and cancer, which it denies. I will say, you know, a couple of countries have banned glyphosate since the article came out. So I think it's being phased out in Germany and in Mexico. So abroad, other countries are looking really differently at this framework.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a fascinating article and wonderful that you decided to concentrate on these plants that have untold properties.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. Thank you.
That was New York Times journalist H. Claire Brown talking about superweeds. I really hope you don't have nightmares. The community of Korean chefs and cooks in Los Angeles is the gift that keeps on giving for those of us who value good eating. Restaurant critic Bill Addison of the Los Angeles Times takes us to a place serving savory pancakes in a style unusual for a restaurant. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan. Good to hear your voice.
It's good to hear yours as well. Where are you taking us?
I am taking you today to the corner of Western Avenue and 6th Street to a four-month-old restaurant called Han Um.
And who is the chef there?
The chef is Wonsuk Kang, or John is his nickname, John Kang, Chef Kang. Jumped into cooking 4 years ago. He was a mortgage broker for 16 years, decided that wasn't his path in life anymore, and he started a food truck in 2017 called Chef Kang, and he has used that as a tagline for a succession of restaurants that he's opened in the Koreatown area. He's done a lot of experimenting with, he would embrace the term fusion, so I will use that word with him. Maybe a kimchi stew on a menu next to a pile of nachos topped with a burger and chicken wings and kind of fun all over the place stuff. With Han Um, he is narrowing his focus to what he would call a modern spin on traditional Korean cuisine.
So you, in your review, you seem to have fallen in love with these pancakes that he is making. Can you tell us about them and explain why they're so different from what we usually see?
Yes. The dish is called Mudum Jun, and it's a combination platter of pancakes or jun. The word jun can actually apply to a bunch of different small pan-fried dishes. Some are more like pancakes and some are more like fritters. Some kind of fall in between. But on Korean restaurant menus, we are used to seeing dishes like the hummel pajeon, which is the big platter-sized scallion and seafood pancake, usually kind of thick and maybe sizzling on a platter. And it's something that you eat as an appetizer or a side dish while you're waiting for a big stew or Korean barbecue. The Mudum Jun kind of goes in a homier direction than we're used to seeing in restaurants. And because of that, it feels incredibly exciting to be able to not only, it's an array of pancakes. So it's fun to try some stuff that isn't usually in the restaurant space. And it's just also really fun to eat a variety of different flavors on this one platter.
So give us an idea of what might come on that platter.
So the first one, gochujang, which is halved jalapenos stuffed with a mixture of finely ground beef and tofu. There is a very chefy version of this on the menu at Major Domo in Chinatown. It's filled with a style of sausage called sock sausage out of Tennessee. David Chang got the recipe from Alan Benton, who's very famous for his bacon. But it was fun to try this version of gochujang, which is a lot closer to the home kitchen style, just really like snappy with the pepper that you kind of bite into the soft filling. It's just very satisfying stuff.
What's another little bite that you had that you loved?
So then there are others that include pollock. Those are kind of a more traditional kind of round pancake, almost latke sized. Smaller ones with that combination of ground beef and tofu in there. A beautiful one, very elaborate, that is made with crab stick and minced mushroom and scallion, other ingredients kind of layered in a beautiful, almost looks like a terrine, and it's kept together with toothpicks to hold this kind of beautiful wobbly rectangle together.
And in Korea, what would a platter like this be served for? What kind of event?
Kang told me that it was the kind of thing that's served at large celebrations, holidays. He mentioned very specifically like a birthday party for someone turning 70, a very kind of special event. He mentioned to me that making the platter, this whole platter, this array of pancakes is a lot of work. And so sometimes he runs out of orders later in the day. The restaurant is open for lunch and dinner, and customers can sometimes grumble at him.
But in the likelihood that that might happen, now that you've written about them.
Yes.
What else on the menu appeals?
So if you are still feeling like pancakes, since we've talked so much about that, there is a version of the hamul pajin, the seafood and scallion pancake, available on this menu. And it's a very solid rendition. It comes out on the sizzling plate, nicely crisp around its circumference. There is a nice version of the hamul pajin, the seafood and scallion pancake, on the menu. There's a really interesting variation on the pancake made with green gram bean, that like the dried beans that you often more see in Indian cuisine, that is ground up and has almost like a chickpea fritter texture to it. But I also really like the stews at this restaurant. There's a lot going on in the menu. He bounces all over the place. There's drinking food, bar food. There are very familiar kind of restaurant style dishes like galbi or bulgogi. He makes a version of galbi jjim with wagyu beef ribs. But I love the stews. There's one that in particular, dak doritang, which is a whole chicken cut up and simmered in a spicy stew. It's nice heat, not too much, not too little, just like a shimmer through the dish. There's also a cool variation of the raw crab dish that's famous at Soban. That's a soy sauce marinade. This is more of a fiery sauce used to ferment with the crab. So yeah, there's plenty to enjoy on this menu, but I do keep coming back to those pancakes.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
Bill Addison is the restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. To find his recommendations for Hanum and other restaurants around town, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. It's the Market Report next. We've got tips for what to do with this season's produce next when Good Food continues. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. And to the farmer's market we go. Jillian Ferguson is in Santa Monica with her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report, and we are back in Santa Monica this week for more fall shopping and what feels like summer weather. I'm talking with Brittany Cassidy, who's the head chef at Violet Bistro. Prior to this, Brittany spent years in the kitchen at Rustic Canyon and then Birdie G's, but now she is running her own show in Westwood. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, Jillian. Good morning.
Good morning. So the menu at Violet is really sweet. I feel like it's a French bistro that took a trip to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. What are you shopping for this week?
So this week, we've noticed that Weiser has incredible honey nut squash. Their yum yum pepper is actually on the same table. Coleman's been supplying us with his sorrel and his radishes. Munich, we actually just finished out, but we had their melon and their tomatoes, their green zebras, their pineapple heirlooms, all in this really beautiful salad that people just gushed over. And then, you know, fall produce, we're getting into this like Indian summer kind of feel. So for me, quince is something that was new to me when I was at Rustic. I had never worked with it before. And the flavor profile was unlike any kind of fruit that I had ever had. And it just stuck with me. And Terry Ranch just has incredible orchard produce that makes my job a little bit easier.
That's what the farmers do, right? So tell us how you're using the quince on the menu now.
So we have the quince two ways on our Basque cheesecake. And the first time I ever used quince, I used it on a cheese plate. And so that kind of just stuck with me every single time I used it. And so right now we're utilizing the French Laundry recipe for their poaching liquid, for their red wine poaching liquid. So we take some of the quince and we poach it in the red wine liquid. And then we're taking another part of the quince and turning it into this quince jam that goes on the base of the cheesecake. And quince is a starchier fruit, so it does hold up its structure really well. You don't have to add a lot of water or a lot of sugar. It just has this really great natural composition that when you blend it into a jam, the texture is just incredible.
And it's just so beautiful.
I mean, it's the red wine poached quince. It's like a work of art. And all you had to do was just follow a simple slow and low cooking technique. Okay. And it really, it's beautiful.
Do you peel the quince before you poach it?
We do. So we utilize the peels in the poaching liquid. So when we bring the red wine up to a boil, we actually include the peels in it. And it just adds an elevated flavor, I think, without having to necessarily throw those peels away.
And for anyone who hasn't seen a Basque cheesecake before, can you just describe it for us?
Absolutely. So what's wonderful about the Basque cheesecake is it actually is crustless. When you're getting cheesecake, you're just getting cheesecake. And the caramelized top isn't necessarily a thick caramelization. It's just the surface of it. So you still get this rich, creamy sweetness all the way through. But that little burnt crust on top adds a little depth of flavor that would have just kind of been a little bit, you know, just like a soft cheesecake.
Well, Brittany, thank you so much. This sounds delicious.
Absolutely. Come in anytime and have yourself a slice.
I can't wait. That was Brittany Cassidy, head chef over at Violet Bistro in Westwood. They're open for dinner every week, Tuesday through Saturday. Becky Terry of Terry Ranch in Dinuba is the farmer who Brittany buys her quince from. And Becky, we've talked about quince before. You have a lot of fun facts about the quince, how it was used in medieval times. Can you just start us off with a little bit of facts about the history of quince?
I would love to. Quince are one of those unusual fruits that have come through during history. They actually have fuzz on them like a peach. They have skin like a pear. They have seeds like a pear, but you're going to use it like an apple. It has a high amount of pectin, so when you cook it, its shape stays what it is. So it's basically a apple with vanilla overtones to it once it's cooked.
And you mentioned that you use it like an apple, but you do cook the quince.
You do. With the amount of pectin that's involved, eating it raw is a real experience with your jaw muscles. You know, we have some of our South American customers that will poach it very much like ceviche with a lemon or a lime juice and change that pectin. But most of our customers actually are using it in baking or desserts. Or if you're Persian, you're going to use it in a lamb stew as the sweet in the savory part of that.
Mm, delicious. So you grow the pineapple quince, which is enormous. I mean, how big can these get?
I have actually had some that's 4.5 pounds each. It looks like a small watermelon or as big as your head if you think about the size.
Wow. There are very few growers who bring these to market. Was quince something that used to be popular in California and just has kind of fallen out of favor?
No, it actually is not. In the entire state of California, there's only 380 acres planted. And California is the biggest grower of quince in the United States. We have 11 acres, which makes us a minuscule fish in a very, very small droplet of water. Quince are something that if you had someone from old school Europe or the Mediterranean, you know how to cook it.
And when you get a customer who's never used it before, what do you like to tell them?
First thing is I've got a real simple recipe. You're going to quarter it. You're going to take the pips out, slice it 1/4 inch long ways, and I saute it. So you're going to put it in butter, saute it first at a high heat, crunch the edges a little bit so you get a little bit of brown, turn it way down, put a lid on it, let the juices. Then I turn it back up after it's changed color and it's fork tender, a little bit of sugar or sweetener, you can use honey, cinnamon and cardamom in it. Then I take that, caramelize it. I put it in a bowl in my refrigerator. I put it over yogurt, ice cream. I actually even will put a spoonful over some chicken breasts with a little red wine and a few cranberries for a little tartness in there and bake it. And it's delicious. It makes a wonderful glaze over your chicken.
You know, something that keeps coming up as I talk to farmers all over the market is this issue of labor. People are having trouble finding enough hands to pick fruit. They're having trouble finding enough people to plant. Have you been experiencing this too at Terry Ranch?
Yes, we are. Now, you have to understand that my husband and I are sole owners of the ranch, and we do not have any outside day laborers that come that work on a daily basis. So we contract our laborers at peak points in our season, typically through our packing house. They supply labor to us during thinning, pruning, and picking. This year, we actually had to wait 3 weeks to get enough men together and ladies to come out and prune our fruit. And they had to delay our pick because they didn't have enough people working the crew line at the packing house, because the apple harvest was early in Washington state. So the labor force picked up and moved to Washington because they had such a demand on the labor up there and left us kind of hanging down here in California.
And I'm curious, because you mentioned packing houses. When you bring the fruit to market, you don't have to go through a packing house. You just get to pick it yourself and bring it right here.
Correct. We have certain acres that come to the farmer's market, which means I pick and pack it myself. We have 11 acres of quince, so about 10 and a half acres goes to our packing house. We're GAP certified, which means that we can ship fruit to United States, Canada, Mexico, and Japan.
Amazing to think that the fruit that we get here at the Santa Monica Farmers Market is also being eaten in Japan right now.
Absolutely.
Well, Becky, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
That was Becky Terry of Terry Ranch in Dinuba. She brings her quince, her pears, her jujubes to the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica Farmers Market every week. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, and Tunisha Venkat for production assistance. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, Paul Smith, and Nick Lamponi. I'm Evan Kleinman. Don't forget to RSVP for the Tortilla Tournament. It's at kcrw.com/tortilla. I'll be back next week with another edition of Good Food.